supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Harry Truman once said, "A pessimist is one who makes difficulties out of opportunities, and an optimist is one who makes opportunities out of difficulties." So, might be an oversimplification, but what is your worldview? Are you confident you can overcome adversity? Or are you worried about what could happen in the future? Are people basically good and kind, or do we need to be wary and protect ourselves? Today's show's about optimism and pessimism. Wonder, are they part of our hardwiring, or are they learned? We'll talk about what role the brain plays in all this, and how out-of-control optimism or pessimism can work against us and can lead to addiction or depression or anxiety. My guest today is Elaine Fox. She's the author of Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain. She's currently a fellow at Magdalen College in Oxford, England, and her work combines cognitive psychology, neuroimaging, and genetics. And she joins us by phone from the UK. Elaine, welcome to Voices in the Family.
Hi, Dan. Thanks very much for having me on the show.
No, it's a pleasure. And if you want to join our conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. Do you consider yourself an optimist or a pessimist? And why? Why do you consider yourself that way? And we'd like to hear about your worldview. Have you always had it? What's happened in your life that may have changed it? Again, that's 888-477-9499. Elaine, I love the way you open your book or one of your chapters with a quote from that Shakespeare said in Hamlet. He said, "There's nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so." I wonder if Shakespeare was a closet Buddhist. But science does seem to support that statement, yes?
Absolutely. My background is in cognitive psychology, and what we've been studying for many years now is the impact that our way of interpreting situations actually has on our outlook. And these kind of cognitive processes tend to go on outside of our awareness. We're often not aware, really, of what our brain is tuning into. And what we find is that the social world, of course, is full of ambiguity. You know, if an old friend passes you by in the street and seems to ignore you, you might interpret that as, you know, he doesn't like you, he doesn't want to stop and talk. Or you might say, well, actually, he looked a bit preoccupied, maybe he just didn't even notice, maybe he didn't recognize you. So the way we interpret those kind of ambiguous situations can really color the rest of your day and really can have a profound impact. And I think it really is the case that these kind of biases can really make a difference to how we see things.
Well, and not just affect your day, but can affect your life depending on your worldview.
Absolutely. And again, one of the things that we've been looking at and which I write about in the book is the idea that effectively what's happening, if we have even a slight tendency to notice negative things rather than positive things, that may only be fractions of a second in terms of, you know, time. But over and over again, if we consistently are making those interpretations and noticing things more, say, that are more negative, over time we're effectively training our brain to really see things in a more negative way. And indeed, in my own research, one of the things I look at is the idea that these kind of slight biases to notice a negative might actually play a causal role in the development of anxiety. So if people are constantly noticing negative information, even though they're not aware of that, over time, of course, they begin to get the impression that the world is actually a much more threatening or dangerous place than actually perhaps it is.
Well, I want to be careful about not making it too black and white. I mean, we do have problem-solving brains. That's the way our brains are wired. It's helped us survive as a species.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and that's one of the reasons the book is called Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain, is that really I'm arguing that we need both aspects of our brain. So I think when you pare everything away, I think the two great motivators in life for every creature on the planet, not just humans, is really to avoid danger. We should avoid predators or any kind of danger or risk as much as we can. And likewise, we should be drawn towards things that are good for us, like food and shelter, for example. So this kind of ancient fear system that we all have is of tremendous use to us. It's you know, we need a fear system in order to avoid danger and to be aware of risk. So I don't think it's a good idea to necessarily try and suppress that fear system. But the problem is when it gets out of control and becomes hypervigilant, you know, and we start seeing danger everywhere, that's when you start having problems.
Well, but it sounds like we're back to what the Buddha said about it's always the middle path. Elaine, we've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation, so let's invite Michael to join us. Hi, Michael, you're on the air. Michael?
Hello?
Hello.
What about people who are extremely ambivalent and see extremes of one or the other without, say, being bipolar?
What do you mean?
Sometimes I believe everyone is saved reincarnation, sometimes everyone damned, and sometimes I have that same extreme left and right view of the human race and human nature. What do you do with people like me other than Science Friday says we should take probiotic pills?
give us an example of what happens in your worldview, you're thinking, Michael?
I have 6 diagnoses I live with. I work and am a member of 4 different organizations for mental health advocacy, volunteer in Philadelphia Summer Winter Community Garden. But well, I have these intense fear where I won't reach out to friends, that I'm almost paralyzed of fear of acting lovingly towards people, and worst of all, even then, the intense depression, clinical depression.
Well, let's see if Elaine can address that, because you're bringing up an important issue, and I'm going to ask you to take the answer off the line. Elaine, I did want to talk about, you know, this the rainy brain pessimism.
Yeah.
And this whole story starts with the amygdala.
Yes.
So tell us about the amygdala.
Okay, well, the amygdala is a tiny part of our brain that is effectively our fear brain. Now, every creature on the planet has an amygdala, which actually isn't too different from our own. It's a very ancient part of the brain in evolutionary terms. And the amygdala, if you like, is almost like an alarm signal. So once there's any danger there, the amygdala will fire. And of course, that's very important. It alerts us to any kind of danger. Now, the amygdala also has a tremendous degree of control over the rest of the brain. It has the ability to stop the rest of the brain in its tracks. For example, let's imagine somebody is terrified of spiders. They may see a spider in the bath. Even though they know rationally the spider isn't actually going to do them any harm, their fear brain just takes over. The amygdala, once it gets going, it just takes over. It can stop everything else in its tracks. Now, the amygdala is an absolutely essential part of our brain. As you said, we need that. But, of course, what sometimes happens is that amygdala can sometimes get a little bit hypervigilant. And as Michael said, sometimes, you know, people get a much more intense fear. And if we start, if the amygdala starts getting overly vigilant and seeing danger everywhere, that's when you start getting problems and people develop anxiety and phobias and other things.
The big question, though, is why is the amygdala so vigilant, so active in some people and not in others?
Well, now, that's a very, very interesting question, and I don't know I have the absolute answer, but the first point is we do know that people differ quite dramatically from each other in how reactive their amygdalas are, and indeed a lot of my own research is looking at exactly that. There's definitely genes are involved to some extent in that. So we know that there are certain genes that affect certain chemicals in the brain that influence how reactive somebody's fear system is. Also, obviously, people's backgrounds, the things that have happened to them, makes a big difference. We know, for example, a lot of soldiers coming back from Afghanistan may develop things like post-traumatic stress disorder, so they tend to have a very hyperactive amygdala. So there's no doubt that the things that happen to us make a difference. Likewise, our genes make a difference. But I think most important of all is really how the genes and the environmental things work together. We know that often genes alone don't make a huge difference, nor do the environmental events make a huge difference on their own. But when they work together, you can get quite toxic combinations.
So we understand that. Now, we also know that we all have a prefrontal cortex, which which is the thinking brain. And so that's supposed to put the brakes on these big emotions.
Yes.
So why doesn't that work in some people?
Well, again, that's exactly right. And these circuits develop between the amygdala and the areas in the prefrontal cortex. And the way I explain it is, it's a little bit like an accelerator and a brake. So the amygdala says run, and the prefrontal cortex says, okay, hold on a second, maybe we don't need to run in this situation. Now, over time, these circuits can strengthen or weaken depending on people's life experiences. And this is really where the training comes in. It's almost as if we can train our brain to be more reactive or to be less reactive. And we know that there are certain techniques, for example, you mentioned Buddhism, for example. Certainly we know that mindfulness-based meditation can make a real difference to how reactive those type of circuits can be. So there are ways those circuits can change. And as I said, you know, the reasons they differ are complex. There's certainly a genetic component. There's also environmental components. But I think the powerful message is that we're now learning more and more ways by which we can actually change how reactive these kind of circuits are.
You know, you talked earlier about reinforcing belief. You said almost as a throwaway line that bad news sells, which is true. It's sad to me, but that just reinforces pessimism, doesn't it? Seeing bad news over and over, and doesn't that kind of stimulate an overreactive amygdala?
It absolutely does, and I think that's one of the problems, that we know the media tends to focus a lot on bad news because we know it captures our attention to a greater extent. And you're absolutely right, of course, that reinforces the activation of the amygdala and the whole fear brain. But I think there's a good biological reason for that. We know that fear always trumps pleasure. Fear, it's almost more important to notice something that's dangerous rather than to notice something that's good. Or as I say in the book, it's better to have lunch rather than to be lunch. So I guess our fear system always has to have the edge to some extent. And the downside of that is that can be abused. And down the ages, I think politicians and priests and religious leaders and all sorts of people have used fear to, you know, kind of capture people's imagination and to scare people. And it is very difficult to ignore. We know it's more difficult to ignore bad news and negative stuff than it is good news.
Yeah, we hear that in the dialogue, certainly in this country and more worldwide, that, you know, if you vote for the other people, terrible things are going to happen.
And it does ratchet
up fear. Let's see if we can get another phone call in before we have to take a break. We've got Jean on the line. Jeannie. Hi, Jeannie.
Yes, I have a question about the aging of the brain and the processes you're discussing. It just seems the older that one gets, the harder it is to remain positive and optimistic in sight of what's going on in the world and in perhaps in your own life. And I just wondered if that was environmental or related to just aging in the brain itself.
Oh, I'm going to challenge you on that, Jeannie. So don't go away, because I'm pretty mature guy anyway. Well, chronologically, I'm mature. Elaine, you want to weigh in on that?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, thanks for the question, Jeannie. But the interesting thing is that the research actually shows the opposite. The research shows that the older people get, the more optimistic they seem to become. And there's a number of recent studies that have been published in the last 6 months showing exactly that as people get older and get more experience, actually they seem to get more optimistic. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. I think one of the things is that once people have been around the block a bit, I don't know if you have that phrase in America, but once you've got a little bit of life experience, I think people get to realize that actually, you know, things happen and they're not as devastating as you might have thought they would be. You know, often people think, well, if I don't get that job or if I don't pass that exam, that's the end of my life. And somebody who maybe is 18 or 19 might think that. But of course, you know, when you fail an exam, you don't get a job you wanted, the more that happens, you realize that actually other better things happened or other things happened. So actually these events aren't necessarily as devastating as you might think they would be. So actually, I suppose I would kind of challenge the original assumption that, I think actually people do get a bit more optimistic, ironically, as they get older.
Well, Elaine and Jerry, I also read a piece of research, a year and a half, 2 years ago, that showed there's actually a part of the brain that flattens out as we age that enables us to see things in context, so that as we age, we begin to see that, like Elaine said, that this moment we begin to see as a moment and not the moment. And, the word for that is called wisdom. Jerry, I also want to share with you a personal reaction. My optimism has increased over time, and I think partly that's because as I age, life becomes more precious to me, and everything becomes more precious, and relationships and days and people and weather. So, you know, as I age, everything becomes more rich to me. I guess I don't have time to ignore stuff like I did before. Jerry, I wish the same for you. Thanks so much for your call. Elaine, we're going to take a short break. We're going to be back in just a minute. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Elaine Fox. She's the author of Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain. She's a fellow at Magdalen College in Oxford, England, and her work combines cognitive psychology, neuroimaging, and genetics. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Do you consider yourself an optimist or a pessimist? If so, why? And I wonder about gender issues. I wonder if you're an optimist, perhaps married to a pessimist. What's that like? Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
Has your teenager changed friends, and are you feeling uncomfortable about them? Is your teenager skipping school or losing interest in their usual activities, and are you concerned with how they are spending their time? The Family Training Program may be able to help. If eligible, you will be invited to attend individual sessions with a family specialist to help you make positive changes in your life and help improve your relationship with your teen. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2 or www.iamconcerned.org. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about optimism and pessimism with Elaine Fox, author of Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain. I want to understand pessimism a little bit better. You know, we've talked in terms of the amygdala, but I wonder if people with rainy brains are more fearful of the world or more withdrawn. Are they less happy?
I think there is a lot of evidence for that. I think the first thing I would say, and I do, you know, argue that we need our rainy brain. There's no question that pessimism can be a very good thing. It can be a little bit more realistic at times. But I think there's certain elements of pessimism that do lead people to be more prone to developing things like anxiety and depression, for example. Now, one of the interesting things as I was researching for the book is that, you know, I became very aware that we often think of pessimism and optimism very much in terms of thinking, either negative thinking or positive thinking. But actually, there are a lot of other components which I think are really important elements of pessimism. So one of the key elements, for example, is pessimism is very much linked with the sense that a person doesn't have much control over their own life. Mm-hmm. So if I'm very pessimistic, I might think, you know, things happen out there in the world, there's really not much I can do about them. Now, that's a very stressful belief system to have and a very stressful feeling to have. And it's probably that sense of control, which is not really anything to do with negative thinking as such, but just that sense that you don't have a lot of control can actually lead to, you know, people feeling unhappy and a little bit depressed. So those kind of elements are often the things that actually make a difference rather than the thinking, if you like, in itself.
I wonder, Elaine, about suffering here. I've got a dear friend of mine, and he is, I mean, he brings pessimism, like, to an art form here.
Right.
You know, he really sees everything as negative, and this kind of almost anger at the way the world is going, and he looks like he's suffering, but I don't think he would have any interest in changing the way his brain functions, because he believes he's right.
Right. And I think that's right. I think, you know, people have their own personality styles. We have our own ways of explaining the world around us. And, you know, I'm often asked the question, should people try and become more optimistic? And, well, my answer would be, well, no, not necessarily. I think there is a lot of evidence that optimism is associated with better health and better well-being. But, of course, you know, a lot of people are actually quite happy in their pessimism. And as you say, it sounds like your friends may be. It sounds ironic, in a sense, to say somebody is happy, you know, being pessimistic. But I think, you know, people get into a certain style of thinking, and it can actually be extremely difficult and quite stressful to change that style of thinking. So I think, you know, if people don't necessarily want to change, there's no real impulsion, I think, to try and become more optimistic, even though the evidence does suggest that, you know, it is linked with better well-being and with the ability to flourish a little bit more.
Mm. Let's go back to the phones, Elaine. We've got Pam on the line. Hi, Pam.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to hear you. And a great show.
Thank you.
I'm 69 years old. I had breast cancer 27 years ago, 17 years ago, and then this past year. And I am a shiatsu massage practitioner, so when I'm sick, I can't work when I'm, you know, after I've had surgery. This time I had 6 months of chemo, so I couldn't work through half of that. But I get up, and I have to say this honestly, I get up every day, and I think I expect it to be a good day. And it usually is. Even when I was going through the worst of the chemo, I had so many people, including my partner, who happens to be out of work right now, even my partner, I mean, just helping and dropping off food and, you know, coming and talking to me. And I couldn't breathe. It affected my asthma. So, but it's a good life. You know, we only get a day, and today I'm fine. And today I'm actually going to be able to work. That's such a blessing. I love what I do. But I think I do understand what your guest is saying. Absolutely, there's hard wiring or chemistry that is just really depressive. I grew up with an adopted mother who was like that. Part of it was I made a decision early on not to be that way because I hated living in a house like that. And part of it for me may be genetics. It may just be how I was wired. But it is also for me a choice.
Tell me
that I have today. It's a beautiful day. I'm looking at my garden, which I'm going to go out and play in a little while. I mean, how I have great kids, fabulous grandchildren. How blessed am I?
Did you always feel that way your whole life?
I went through a period of being bullied when I was in sixth grade, and it was the only time I felt like maybe this life wasn't worth living. But I'm adopted, and I thought, I can't do that to my parents. And that bullying passed. You know, it was one half of one school year. And after that, I've been pretty optimistic. I have to say.
I wonder. Thank you so much, Pam, for your call. I wonder, Elaine, about adversity. You know, Elaine talked about bullying. Pam talked about bullying. She also started her conversation talking about breast cancer three times. So
yeah.
I wonder about adversity and could adversity make one more optimistic? I know it has in my life. Both of my parents were pessimists. And, when I began to experience severe adversity, over time, I've become more optimistic. Any research on that?
Yes, there is a lot of research on that, and you're absolutely right. What the research shows is that actually when people experience adversity, they're often surprised at actually how resilient they are. And it turns out that most of us are actually pretty resilient. If you ask people, how do you think you would feel if, you had a terrible accident or you got breast cancer, all of these things, people understandably would say, well, I would really find that difficult to cope with. It would be extremely difficult. My life would be far less quality than it does now. And then often what happens is people, when they go through these kinds of experiences, actually find that they have far more depth than they thought they had. And that's a very empowering type of thing. So, I think the old quote, what doesn't kill us makes us stronger, I think that's absolutely true. The research evidence suggests that when we go through adversity, many of us actually develop a what's often called a post-traumatic growth rather than post-traumatic stress.
And
so people grow as people and find these depths to themselves that they weren't aware of initially.
And more people experience post-traumatic growth and post-traumatic stress, but we mental health professionals over the years tend to focus on pathology, I guess, because as a group we tend to be pessimistic.
That's right, and I think it's very interesting in psychological science. All of the research up to fairly recently was on the negative side of things, so anxiety, depression, pessimism, addictions. It's only really fairly recently that psychology and neuroscience has turned its attention to what makes us flourish. Really asking this question, where does resilience come from? How do we flourish? So we're really looking at the positive side of life rather than the negative side of life. So I think you're absolutely right. There has been this tendency to study the dark side, if you like, or the negative things that happen. Whereas now I think psychologists and neuroscientists are really beginning to look into what makes us flourish and the sunny brain side of things.
Mm. We're talking with cognitive psychologist Elaine Fox, author of Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain. We're talking about optimism and pessimism. Our number is 888-477-9499. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Jennifer on the line. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Dr. Dan and Elaine. My question or comment was about using the power of positive thinking. I mean, I've tried to change myself from being primarily a pessimist to being more optimistic, and I found doing affirmations and remaining positive and focusing on positive outcomes has really helped me with my pessimism. And I also just wanted to say that I had to laugh when Elaine mentioned that story in the beginning, because that actually happened to me in college. I got miffed because a friend was on the other side of the street. I thought he had ignored me. I got upset for like a week or two. And then all of a sudden, I decided to confront him, and he said he told me he never even saw me that day. He was in his own world. And I just thought that was a riot. And I've used that as a lesson to myself in many other occasions.
Elaine, I wonder about changing. Does the power of positive thinking, does it help? Or what forms of it do help change a pessimistic brain to an optimistic one. Jennifer, thanks so much for your call.
Well, I think it's very interesting what Jennifer says there. I think there's no doubt that positive thinking can be very powerful and can make us feel a lot better and can really help us. But one of the things that the research has shown is that actually a lot of the benefits of optimism don't come from positive thinking. They come more from positive actions. So the things we actually do that make a difference. So people who are naturally very optimistic tend to act in a very optimistic way, like, or in a very positive way. And one of the things that I really realized when I was interviewing lots and lots of people for the book was that, you know, I'm not talking here about a kind of a blind optimism. If we simply put our head in the sand and just think everything is going to be wonderful, that's not actually a very sensible way to live our lives. You know, again, I think I gave the example, if you imagine a mother with her little toddler running towards a busy road, you know, if she kind of has the optimistic take that, oh, you know, he's not going to be hit by a car, you know, most of us would say, well, that's a pretty crazy way to deal with the world. So she would obviously take the pessimistic view and hopefully pick him up before he runs to the road. So I think it's an optimism combined with the realism that's the really healthy mindset to have. So, you know, a lot of people said to me, for example, who were quite optimistic, they said things like, you know, it's not that I don't think things are going to go wrong. I'm absolutely, totally aware that things are going to go wrong and some things will go right. But the overarching sense is that, you know, I'm going to be able to deal with whatever life throws at me. So I think, you know, this kind of idea that you're just having positive thoughts is enough is wrong, really. It can make us feel better. It can be very helpful. And obviously, positive thinking and positive actions are related to each other. But I think the real benefits often of optimism come from the absolute actions, just getting out there and doing things. And again, I'm sure you know, Dan, in terms of clinical work, people who are depressed or overly pessimistic, often what they'll say is that, you know, I just can't be bothered to go out and do anything. So it often becomes a very, very passive way of living. And, of course, that just then reinforces itself. Whereas, you know, people who are more optimistic are more likely to get out and try things. And even if they fail, they'll keep trying again. And eventually, of course, something is going to work out well. So I think, you know, a lot of those kind of benefits in terms of success and health actually come from the actions more than the positive thinking.
You know, it reminds me of a phrase in Alcoholics Anonymous where they say, fake it until you make it. And it turns out to be true biologically, neurologically, that if you go out and engage in healthy behaviors, in time your body, brain will become healthier, will fall in line.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Yeah, acts of generosity tend to increase one's sense of well-being.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
Yeah, that's pretty easy, huh? That's pretty easy to do. We've got to take a short break, Elaine. We're going to come back in just 1 minute, and I want to talk to you more about meditation and other exercises we can engage in, similar to what Jennifer said about how we can help alter our worldview. We're talking with cognitive psychologist Elaine Fox. She's a fellow at Magdalen College and the author of Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
Christiana Care Health System's Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, Christiana Care cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year, and the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. Christiana Care, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with cognitive psychologist Elaine Fox, author of Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain, and it is about optimism and pessimism. I wonder, Elaine, do we have any research about optimism and pessimism broken down by gender, by culture, economics?
Well, it is quite interesting, actually, because overall it looks like there's not much difference in terms of optimism. The research doesn't seem to show much difference, even though we know that there is a higher rate of, say, depression and anxiety in women. But I'm sure you're very well aware there's a lot of controversy about those figures and whether it's to do with the fact that women are more willing to admit to your feelings of despair and feelings of depression. But in terms of optimism, it doesn't really look like there's too much difference between the different genders, between men and women. Also, culturally, again, there are some differences, but again, it's often very difficult to really boil it down to what the genuine differences are, because in some cultures, it's not particularly acceptable to say, you know, you're feeling either very optimistic or you're not feeling very optimistic. Mm. I think in the US, for example, it almost seems obligatory a lot of the time to say you're feeling optimistic and upbeat a lot of the time, whereas in other cultures, it might be the opposite. So I think there's a lot of really interesting research going on at the moment on those kind of questions, and I think there's a lot more we need to learn there.
So let's talk about how we can make a rainy brain more sunny. Let's start by talking about what we now know about neuroplasticity and how brains change, even an aging brain.
Exactly. I think neuroplasticity is a fascinating area, which I write about in Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain. Your listeners may know there's a famous study was done several years ago on London taxi drivers. London taxi drivers have to do a very difficult test called the knowledge, which means that they have to learn every single one of the almost 30,000 streets in London, which are all, you know, they don't go in nice horizontal and vertical lines like a lot of US cities do. Now, the interesting thing is that the hippocampus is an area of our brain that deals with spatial navigation. And what the researchers found was that the longer a London cab driver was actually driving cabs, the bigger their hippocampus actually grew. So in other words, by simply learning spatial navigation skills, that had a direct effect on their brain, on the actual structure of their brain. And really what I'm arguing in my book is that these same kind of neuroplastic mechanisms can take place in terms of our attitudes. So if we're highly pessimistic, you know, or highly optimistic, we can really, this really relates back to fundamental changes in how the brain operates in terms of these rainy brain and sunny brain circuits.
So if traditionally, you know, if we've got someone with an overactive amygdala who's anxious or depressed, the first line of intervention is medication. And, you know, we know that often medication helps, but it doesn't really change the brain, does it?
Well, this is very, very interesting. There's a lot of techniques that we now know do change the brain. So we know that I talked earlier about the idea that these fundamental cognitive biases in what we notice are really at the heart of who we are. They're really at the heart of these pessimistic or optimistic mindsets. Now, we know that things like the traditional talking therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, definitely does change those biases, and those biases in turn change how the brain operates. So everything kind of feeds into itself. Now, there's some very, very interesting work by a colleague of mine in Oxford, Catherine Harmer, who does some very interesting work on the effect of antidepressant drugs. And what she's found is that antidepressants also seem to change these fundamental biases. So in other words, they shift a bias in a more positive direction. And her argument is that, in fact, the benefits that come from antidepressant drugs don't come so much from the drug itself, but it comes from the fact that once you shift your mindset into a more positive direction, that then leaves you open to much more positive social interactions. So just like one of your earlier callers said, you know, that story resonated with her, the idea that if somebody, you know, doesn't speak to you, you think they may be ignoring you. If you take a more positive interpretation of that, that, of course, will lead to a much more optimistic mindset. So the research in Oxford suggests that if someone takes an antidepressant, that can shift their mindset in a slightly more positive direction. And then, of course, that in turn means that if people are now making consistently more positive interpretations, that then becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy and becomes self-reinforcing. So it's kind of quite interesting that it's almost like the antidepressant is kick-starting the cognitive system, but it's the cognitive system that ultimately is having the benefits. So, of course, there are other ways we can change our biases through either talking therapies, or there's a technique that I've been using called cognitive bias modification, which is kind of a brain training mechanism almost. Well, but the key thing is, I think, if we can change those biases, that is what really can lead to changes in our brain and to changes in how we are.
You just glossed over something that I want to hear a lot more about, and that was how we change those cognitive biases. What was it that you mentioned, that technique?
Yes, it's a technique we've been using called cognitive bias modification, or CBM, it's often called. Now, it's quite different from cognitive behavioral therapy. Basically, the techniques that I've been looking at, I've been trying to target biases in our attention. So these biases are where our brain and our attentional system zones in very, very quickly to the more negative or the positive aspects of the world. Now, these things are happening extremely quickly, and we're generally not aware of them. But as I was saying earlier, what I believe is happening is that the more we're actually tuning in to, say, the more negative parts of the world, that's effectively training our brain to have a more pessimistic kind of outlook. So what we're trying to do is use these very simple computer-based tasks to effectively try and shift those biases in a more positive direction. So I can explain very simply the kind of techniques we're using. We basically flash up two images, so two pictures on a computer screen very, very quickly, and one of those might be a negative scene and one might be a positive scene. And then the images disappear very quickly and people have to press a button according to where they see a little target that appears on the screen. Now, the trick is that sometimes that target appears in the location where a negative scene had been, sometimes it appears where the positive scene had been. So this gives us a kind of a sneaky way of assessing attentional biases. So a very pessimistic person, for example, would be a little bit quicker in picking up the target if it appeared near a negative image. Now, in our cognitive bias modification procedure, what we do is we set up the contingency so that 100% of the time, the target always appears in the opposite location to the threatening image or to the negative image. So people go through hundreds and hundreds of these examples on a computer screen. So it's a little bit boring, but people sit in front of a computer screen. And effectively what the hope is that by pressing these buttons, which are always in the opposite location to the negative images and in the location of the more positive images, that effectively their brain is becoming retrained to start shifting towards the more positive and away from the negative.
So speaking of retraining the brain by engaging in these repetitive motions, you referred earlier to mindfulness meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that retrain the brain?
Well, I think, again, there is a lot of evidence now that mindfulness meditation can, in fact, change these brain circuits. As we said earlier, the key circuits are involved in, say, linking up the amygdala with areas in the prefrontal cortex. So, say, that would be the rainy brain circuit. Now, a lot of research has been done measuring how strongly that circuit reacts, say, before mindfulness meditation, and then again about 8 weeks after people are doing a mindfulness-based meditation fairly regularly for, say, typically for an eight-week period. And what they found is that what the mindfulness seems to do is it actually strengthens the control circuits. So the areas in the prefrontal cortex that inhibit the amygdala are actually strengthened. So people develop a more powerful way of controlling their amygdala. So the amygdala itself doesn't actually, it doesn't fire any less, but it is actually inhibited a little bit more by strengthening the control centers in the brain.
You know, I've been practicing meditation for about 15 years, and the most powerful impact that I'm aware of anyway is the fact that when I am sitting there while I'm practicing, I can have these powerful emotions or these wonderful or horrible thoughts, and whatever they are, I just sit there. I mean, I have no choice. I just sit there and return to my breath or whatever it is I'm attending to. And I think what I've learned over over the years is to, or my brain has, is simply to be less reactive, to be less respectful even of my big thoughts or my big emotions, because they pass.
Yes, that's right. And I think this is one of the really powerful things, actually, about meditation and really just getting back to what we were saying earlier, just really coming to the realization that a lot of these thoughts we have and worries we have are actually just that. They're thoughts in our head. So they can come into our head, they can go out again. And as one of the things you learn in meditation is that you don't necessarily have to let them in. So we do actually have a lot of control about, you know, the impact of these thoughts. So if somebody's worrying a lot about, say, you know, their son being in a car crash, for example, I mean, that's a very distressing thought. But actually, it is just a thought. You know, it doesn't actually bear any relation to what actually is going to happen. So I think learning that and being aware that these thoughts can come and go and don't necessarily have to have a big impact on you is a very, very powerful thing. And exactly as you said, I think a lot of people who do these meditation techniques really come to that realization. And I think it's probably that really helps when you do come into a crisis. It almost gives you a kind of a buffer, if you like, to deal with adversity if it does happen.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Olivia on the line. Hi, Olivia.
Hi. Hey, I just have a question, but before I give it to you, I wanted to just say that I remember Marianne Williamson saying one way for people to feel better or more optimistic is to feel appreciated, and she suggests going to a battered women's shelter or working in a soup kitchen or something. And so that seems to be a really nice idea.
Yeah.
My question is about the media consumption. So one of the things I've noticed about myself is if I watch a lot of news or any kind of violent programs or movies, I feel depressed, so I now avoid them, and I feel pretty optimistic a lot of the time. I just wonder if there's any research around that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Yeah, for news, if I were you, I'd stick with NPR. Not that I'm biased or anything. Elaine,
yes?
Any research on the impact of media?
Yes, absolutely, and I think your caller is absolutely right. It is true that the media often is full of all sorts of negative things, and of course it can be very, very upsetting. I mean, we have a program over here called Crime Watch. I'm sure you have something similar in the US.
Many.
Which is about all the local crimes that go on, and you know, a lot of people look at that and then get extremely frightened. So I think an obvious way is as your listener said, to avoid those kind of situations. So I think there is a lot of research showing that, you know, we can. It's a little bit like avoiding the distressing thoughts. But I think we obviously need to get it in balance. And this is where, you know, we've been talking about we don't want to suppress the fear side of our brain completely, because there are times when we need to tune into the negatives. Because if somebody, say, discovers a lump in their breast, for example, you know, you need to absolutely be aware of that and do something about it. So I think it's kind of getting that balance right. But certainly, I think, in terms of the media, it can actually. I think all of us just need to kind of step back and realize, you know, we do have some control over what we pay attention to. And the more we pay attention to negative things, the more negative we're likely to be. So, you know, I think, you know, just trying to bring a bit more positive into our lives is actually very healthy.
Are you an optimist?
I think I'm definitely an optimist, yes.
Were you always?
I think I probably was, yes. I mean, I think I've obviously gone through periods of pessimism like everyone, but I think generally speaking, I've always had an overall sense that, you know, things would work out pretty well, and I tend to, you know, I tend to be, I think, quite active in pursuing things and feel quite optimistic about how things are going to go. Although I think, you know, I'm kind of a bit of a realist as well.
You know, I've got to tell you, Elaine, as one mental health professional to another, I've been in this field for over 40 years now, and I've got to tell you, this is one of the most exciting periods in our field that I've ever experienced. It's like we're just beginning to integrate brain and behavior and East and
yes.
West and spirituality and ways of modifying our brains and our lives. It's very exciting, and the potential feels unlimited.
Absolutely. Well, I totally agree with you, and I think it's such an exciting time. And you know, I've just recently started doing a lot of work with geneticists, for example, in incorporating genetics with a more spiritual approach in terms of meditation and looking at these ways of changing biases and whether that can change people. And as you say, I think it's wonderful that neuroscience and psychology and spirituality and genetics are all coming together now and really looking at how can we, improve human well-being. And it's I think we're really making genuine progress.
So let me ask the optimist in 30 seconds to tell me what's your vision of where we will be as a field in 10 years.
Well, fascinating question. I think the big hope is that we will be able to develop much more tailor-made interventions for people. I think one of the problems, in a sense, it's an understandable problem, is that a lot of the research tends to focus very much on general interventions. So in general, if somebody's depressed, what are the best type of interventions? But of course, every mental health professional knows that people differ quite dramatically from each other, and they differ in how they respond to different kind of therapies. So I think one of the exciting things now is that the more we're learning about these individual brain circuits and particular sets of genes, the hope is that maybe in 10 years' time we might be closer to being able to identify...
So what we have... Unfortunately, we're out of time, so what we have to tell our audience is just stay tuned. Elaine Fox, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
We've been talking about optimism and pessimism. She's the author of Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to re-air our show on the healing power of poetry with Ellen Bass. It was a wonderful show. Well, you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com, and you can reach our production team at voices@whyy.org. Well, to download a show or listen to past shows, you can go to whyy.org/voices. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our volunteer. Jerome Goldman is our summer intern. And we've had great help from Alexa Kaczmarski. Mike and Scott is our executive producer, and she produced today's show. Jennifer Lynn's our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.
The National Multiple